Welcome, everybody. This is the third office hours session for our tour of Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. We just wrapped up Chapter 6 in last week's lecture, and we are now just making a general announcement. You guys should be getting the emails, but just on the off chance some of you aren't checking that and you're listening to this in time. The Chapter 7, which is Lecture 4 for this class, we're actually doing it ahead of schedule because Peter Klein is going to be the guest lecturer. Just, I've said this before, but I'll just say it again to make sure everyone knows what's going on. So I toyed with initially when I was going to go through Man, Economy, and State, I felt like, am I going to be hogging an obvious wealth of material for Mises Academy? And so I had toyed with the idea of letting other faculty members, you know, come in and do various chapters. It turned out, for various reasons I won't go into, the logistics of it, the timing, people's availability, and so forth, and then the coherence for you, the student. Like, if you have a bunch of different people teaching two lectures in an 8-week course, you know, you might feel like it's not a coherent class. So anyway, that's why we're dipping our toe in this time around to see how it goes. Peter Klein teaches the material that's in Chapter 7 of Man, Economy, and State. When we do the Rothbard Graduate Seminar and we're going through Man, Economy, and State, we don't do that every year, but the years for which Man, Economy, and State is the text that we go through, that's the stuff that Peter goes over. And so that's kind of like his specialty, and he's able to relate it to mainstream stuff a lot better than I would be able to. I mean, I can certainly go through Rothbard and paraphrase what he's saying and clarify it. I mean, I wrote the study guide, but the point is I think Peter is more up to speed with the current mainstream thinking in these areas, and you know, he might just be able to give you more as a lecturer on this particular chapter. So that's why he's doing it. The problem is he couldn't do it at the regular scheduled time next week since he's going to be, I think, like in South America or something. So anyway, we were concerned that he would not have a good internet connection if he leaves the country, and so that's why he's just doing it today. So you did get an email. You can go to Moodle and check the announcements if for some reason you didn't get the email. But Peter Klein, today, Saturday, what is this, August 6th, is giving the lecture this evening for what's Lecture 4, and it's going to be Chapter 7. All right, so obviously, it'll be recorded and everything if it's not convenient, and I apologize for the late notice and having the lecture be on a Saturday, since you probably didn't realize that when you got into this. Okay, let's now look at the questions. One other general thing, I truly am, I know I've said it before, but I really am going to get all caught up on the questions for the professor. I was going to do it yesterday, but then Krugman wrote a column that was just begging for refutation, so I had to do that, get that in the works, and now I'm free to catch up with your guys' questions. Okay, Louis says, I was very delighted to find out about the study guide to the theory of money and credit by Mises, already available on PDF since last week. Yeah, that's something that it was a quiet work in progress. I think I started doing that in December. I started writing that, and then I was almost finished with it, and then a bunch of stuff came up, and then I finally knocked it out. And so, yeah, for those of you who don't know, I have a study guide for Human Action and Man, Economy, and State. Now we just came out with Study Guide to Theory of Money and Credit, and so the PDF for sure is already up. And I think at this point the physical book probably exists because they were just going to miss getting it in for Mises U, but that was last week or 2 weeks ago. I mean, I'm mixed up now. It was the last week of July. So by now I think the book physically exists. They went with a spiral binding just like with the other ones. So yeah, it's should be neat. And the neat thing too is the theory of money and credit was not as hard as I remember it being. Right, so when they commissioned me to do that, I was thinking, oh, man, I'm going to have to roll up my sleeves and really, you know, get a personal trainer or something to get through this thing. Because when I tried read, well, I mean, I did read it, but I don't think I comprehended that much of it when I was, I think, an undergrad, like a sophomore or something. I got the Liberty Classics version of Theory of Money and Credit, and I tried reading it, and I think a lot of it was over my head. But now, going back to it, it's actually not as hard as I remember it. It's just that it's a difficult subject matter, and Mises had to define a bunch of new terms, and so it is, it's not like reading a mystery novel, that's for sure, but it's actually not that excruciating or that grueling as I kind of thought it was. So especially if you're armed with my study guide and you've always wanted to tackle that, I really would encourage you guys to give it a shot. Because let me also say this, you might think, oh, well, what's the point? Anything that was important in Theory of Money and Credit, Mises would have put in Human Action, or then Rothbard would have put it in Man, Economy, and State, so I don't need to go back and read that tome from 1912. There's a lot in Theory of Money and Credit that I have not seen elsewhere. Okay, Mises talks a lot about international trade in terms of like the balancing of the international trade accounts. He talks a heck of a lot about the gold standard and just using gold as money, that you don't see that sort of in-depth discussion anywhere else, or at least I haven't seen it anywhere else. You know, I'm sure he must have talked about it here and there, but in terms of the standard stuff, the canonical Austrian works, there's a lot in Theory of Money and Credit that you probably haven't seen before. And also just to be blown away by Mises' command of the literature, because he's just read everything on these subjects, and it's just for you to be amazed that, holy cow, this is why we have an institute named after this guy. Because he's just amazing. Okay. Benjamin says, Dr. Mark Faber, is it Faber or Faber? I used to know how to pronounce his name, now I forget. Says that next week we will find out if Bernanke is a real money printer or just an amateur. Considering the effect of the first two QEs in world reaction, what do you think? Well, I mean, I agree that next week is going to be critical. If they don't inflate next week, I may have to revise my views as to the dollar collapsing and everything. I mean, that's sort of, I've been among the forefront of Austrians who are sounding like paranoid nut jobs by saying I really do think there might be plans to crash the dollar at some point, and they're trying to paint us into a corner where it looks like it was an accident. So, I mean, I have publicly talked about crazy stuff like that. So if next week, if Bernanke doesn't, you know, if they come out and announce that they're not going to do anything, then that will make me think that maybe this really is just an intellectual mistake. And then up till now, they actually thought they were helping, and then now they're not sure. And they're actually not trying to wreck the dollar. So if you're asking me what do I think they're going to do, I'm not confident at all in this prediction, but my guess is they're going to announce some sort of – they're not going to call it QE3, that's for sure. Because they just, you guys know, they didn't even call it QE1 or QE2. Well, I'm not sure if they didn't call it QE1, but for sure, no Fed announcement ever called it QE2 or, you know, a second round of quantitative easing. They didn't call it that. That was just what people in the financial sector dubbed it. Okay, well, there's a storm going on here, so hopefully my connection doesn't get messed up. All right, so just so you guys know, that the Federal Reserve never officially referred to the thing that they announced after the 2010 elections, they never called that QE2. I don't know why. Maybe just because they didn't want to make it look like they were printing money, but that's just what people in the market called it and the pundits call it, but the Fed never called it that. So for sure, next week they're not going to say we're announcing QE3. They're not going to call it that. But they may – I don't know, because the reason I'm saying this is I don't quite get – what the reluctance has been to inflate. I mean, Paul Krugman in his latest column said that the Fed has allowed itself to become intimidated by Ron Paul types. And that sounds kind of funny to me. Like, I mean, I guess I don't know enough really about the power struggles, and I don't know how much actual power Ron Paul really has. But I don't think Bernanke is afraid of Ron Paul per se. I think the danger with Ron Paul is he can get the whole country whipped up into a frenzy and turn public opinion against the Fed and make people start questioning what the Fed is doing and then demanding an audit and wanting to look at their books and see who have they been giving billions of dollars to. I think that's a concern. And so, you know, I don't think, in other words, that Bernanke's sitting there running his models and saying, oh my gosh, the LM curve is more elastic than we thought and blah, 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 so we need to inflate more and, oh shoot, though, that's going to push up inflation expectations and then Ron Paul might get mad at me. I don't think that's what's going on. I think it's more, holy cow, for the last 2 years we have been breaking so many laws, giving money to foreign companies and things like that, just doing stuff that is flat out illegal, and we're going to go to jail for the rest of our lives if anyone ever finds this stuff out. And so we do not want people poking their heads around or their noses around what we've been doing. And if I keep inflating, Ron Paul is not going to let this thing drop. And so, you know, like I say, not that what I just described is exactly what's going on, but I think it's closer to that than an austere debate over monetary policy. So given if that is what's going on, it's hard to know what the Fed's going to do, because I think their inclination would be to inflate. I mean, just that's the weird thing here. Normally, you would think that, oh, it's popular to inflate, you know, to print money, and of course they're not literally printing it. They're just electronically creating it. To create a bunch of money, throw it around, have everyone feel good, and when it causes a general boom, but then the problem occurs once prices start rising too much and people start griping about consumer price inflation. I mean, that's the normal way things happen in the Austrian boom-bust cycle. Let me just catch this one. I see Lewis saying, so does that mean next Wednesday we're having Lecture 5? No, we're not. We're going to get back on the regular schedule. Okay, so we're just Peter Klein tonight, August, I keep forgetting what day it is, August 6th is giving the Lecture 5, and then we're not, so that means this coming Wednesday, August 10th, we're not having a lecture, and then we're going to do Lecture 5 on August 17th, but that's a good point, Lewis. I should clarify that, since it wouldn't be obvious that that's how we're doing it. So as far as what the Fed is doing, that standard thing is not quite working this time around. That there has been no boom, except for that one, with inflation. Right? It's, even though I think Bernanke did postpone the awful recession that would have happened in late 2008 by doing all the stuff he did. The point is, this certainly doesn't feel like we're in the midst of prosperity, of false prosperity, where there's capital consumption going on. This still feels awful. So inflating has not been as popular as it normally would be on the upswing of a business cycle. So it really has been the case this time around that Bernanke has inflated just to bail out really powerful rich people, and everyone else is mad. Like, you know, more and more people don't like the bailout. They don't like what Bernanke's been doing, and they're getting suspicious that he's just giving money to a bunch of rich people who made a bunch of mistakes during the housing bubble. So, whereas the average homeowner's underwater and unemployed and blah, blah, blah. So I think they really are under a lot of pressure, and even though you've got economists, I mean, it's just shocking to me. Tyler Cowen at GMU, who is considered to be a libertarian guy, I don't know if he calls himself a libertarian. He doesn't call himself Austrian, that's for sure. I mean, he just recently lamented that we needed inflation in this thing, and we are a nation of cowards, that we didn't support Bernanke in inflating more. I mean, I just can't believe that's where the academic debate has gotten to at this point. So I'm sort of rambling here to answer your question, but I'm just saying there's a lot of different things going on. In terms of the standard academic debate, bloggers cannot understand why Bernanke is not played anymore. They think it's just an open and shut case that, yeah, of course you would inflate more in a situation like this. What possible downside could there be? Long-term inflation expectations are really low. You've got high unemployment, a lot of slack resources. Wow, it is really pouring here. So, like I said, I hope my power doesn't go out or my internet connection doesn't go out. So anyway, I don't know. If I had to guess, I would say he's going to announce something just because I think deep down Bernanke is there to bail out the powerful interests, and they're going to tell him, yeah, it's going to be uncomfortable, but that's what you're there for, Ben. That's why you're going to get the plush consulting salary after you get out of that post. But for right now, you're our guy, and we just took a beating in the stock market. You need to print more. But I'm not, like I say, I'm not confident of that prediction. I've actually been surprised at how timid the Fed has been lately. Okay, Benjamin says, Trends Research Journal publisher Gerald Salent said that we need a direct democracy in the U.S. He said that if it can work in Switzerland, it can work here. Responding to the idea that the public is too ignorant to make this workable, he said that the politicians aren't any better. What is your view on this matter? Well, I haven't read Salent's piece, but no, I mean, that would just make things worse. Well, I don't know if it would make things worse, but that's not going to solve anything. I mean, I assume he means by direct democracy that the people just directly vote on stuff, like you don't have intermediate representatives, alleged representatives, so you have just everyone gets on a computer and decides how much are we going to spend on defense this year, or are we going to raise taxes, yes or no? I'm sure there are, on the margin, pros and cons for doing it that way versus the current system, but that would be an awful system if we implemented that. There would be no chance for what you and I think of as liberty if they did that. I mean, that's literally mob rule, okay? And the problem with it is, you don't want the public thinking that the government is just implementing their will, because then there are no constraints at all on what the government can do. All right, so people, and this is kind of part of what Hans Habe's critique of democracy is, that under, for example, monarchy, even though from a certain point of view that is just an insane system, you know, and Thomas Paine ridiculed it and so forth, it is true that from a certain point of view, especially the idea of hereditary monarchy, that's crazy. Why should some family be in charge of everybody else just because of their DNA? It doesn't make any sense. That's nuts. And it is nuts. But the one virtue of that system is the people who are ruled understand full well that they're not in charge, that they are being ruled over by some outside entity, and so they are more jealous of their prerogatives, and they're going to be a lot more adamant about especially like the nobles and stuff, are going to be a lot more adamant about not letting the king overstep his bounds, even though those bounds are illegitimate. Whereas if you have democracy, and the public really thinks, well, no, and in our country, when the government does something, it's because that's what the people want, and they don't think, oh, it's because that's what the king wants. Well, then, why would you need a constitution, for example? The government should be able to do whatever it wants. You in your own life, you don't have a constitution with yourself. You just do whatever you think is the right thing to do. Because what sense would it make to have a constitution with yourself to say, well, even if next week I think doing X is the best thing for me, right now I want to constrain myself so I can't do that next week. It doesn't make, why would you do that? If right now you know what the right thing to do next week is going to be, well, then next week you should be able to figure that out. If you change your mind because of new information, you don't want to box yourself in and then not be able to do the right thing because you foolishly constrained yourself earlier on. Okay, so by the same token, if you think the government is just implementing the general will of the public, why would the public want there to be any constraints at all on the types of thing the government could do? They wouldn't worry about there being tyranny. They'd say, you can't tyrannize yourself. Right? There's not going to be a dictator. The government does whatever we want. If the government starts doing something bad, we'll make a change. That's why we have a democracy. So a lot of political thinkers, including Hans Hoppe, think that is one of the supreme dangers of democracy, is that it fools people into thinking the government is just them, and that they're all one big collective that acts, and that's not really what happens. Even if you had direct democracy, the power elites would still be able to orchestrate what happens. You know, the media would still frame the debate. The determination of which bills came upon which to be voted up or down by the public, I mean, that would not just be some spontaneous outburst of the public will. That would all be carefully manipulated to get the result the people in power wanted. Just like, in theory right now, the general members of the political parties pick their candidates through the primary process. But I mean, in an 08 election, no Republican that I know of likes John McCain. Of the people who had been in the running, John McCain was not at the top of anybody's list. So it's true, some people wanted Ron Paul, some people wanted Rudy Giuliani, some people wanted Mitt Romney, and whatever. So, I mean, you can kind of explain it that way. It wasn't like there was some clear favorite. But the point is, nobody liked John McCain. And I think part of what happened there was the people in charge decided Barack Obama was going to be the next president. So they met with Hillary Clinton and told her, you're stepping aside, we'll make you Secretary of State in the Obama administration, but we think for various reasons we want him to be the front man, not you. And then they made sure that the Republican didn't win because they put up John McCain, who sucked, that nobody was going to vote for John McCain. All right, so I think that's – and yet the average person thinks, well, no, we live in a representative democracy where – we have political parties, and I'm a registered Republican, and I went to my precinct or whatever, and I voted for the guy I wanted, and up. Well, you know, the rules are the rules, and John McCain won fair and square, and he didn't win fair and square. I've talked to Ron Paul delegates who went to these primary conventions, and they told me stories about the stuff that, like, the local committee chairman did to make sure Ron Paul didn't win, you know, that particular thing. So, stuff, you know, like reading the rules and just throwing out ballots and just all kinds of crazy stuff. Okay, so it's I'm not saying Ron Paul would have been the Republican nominee in 08 if everyone played fair. I'm just saying it's very naive when people think that, oh, in our system, the people decide who the nominees are going to be, and then they go out and have a general election, and may the best man win. That's not how it works. And something comparable would happen, I think, with direct democracy, that the people would falsely believe they were running the government when they wouldn't. Okay, Benjamin says, last year, analyst Jim Rickards said that gold was undervalued by the U.S. government during the Great Depression, and that if it had been valued upward, it would have shortened the span of the Depression. Is he right, and why? Well, I'm not... There's various ways of answering that. So in general, no. I mean, if you're asking me, why did the Depression last so long? The answer that pops to my mind is not, oh, because the U.S. government undervalued gold. I mean, that's not what I would give as the reason. The Depression lasted so long because you had unprecedented intervention by the federal government into the economy, first under Herbert Hoover and then more so under FDR. And that's how I would explain why the economy couldn't recover, because the government kept kicking it while it was down. I mean, hands down, the New Deal was the closest the U.S. economy has ever come to peacetime central planning. And under World War II, there really was central planning for all intents and purposes. I mean, it wasn't like the Soviet Union, but it was pretty closely regulated. So, why should we be surprised that you really didn't have a genuine recovery, especially in the private sector, until 1946? That's exactly what you would expect to happen. What would have been surprising is if we had a recovery during the New Deal. That would be a puzzle to be explained. But if you believe in free markets, you know, and FDR comes in and does all this crazy stuff, what do you think is going to happen? Now, I obviously don't know what Jim Rickards said, but here's what you could say that maybe is sort of what he has in mind. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And in like 30, 31, there's banking panics. So there's a fractional reserve banking system, and people are taking their money out of the banks because they don't trust the banks. If the bank failed back then, you didn't have FDIC. You could, we say you lose your money. I think what was more accurate was to say depositors wouldn't have access to their money because the bank takes in a bunch of deposits and then makes loans of various lengths and, you know, investments of various maturities, and then if everyone runs to the bank right away and wants their money back, the bank just doesn't have it. But if you're willing to wait in the bank and say, hey, we lent the money out to this guy for a year, when he pays us back in a year, we'll have your money, that kind of thing. Or, you know, we made a loan to this business person, he's paying it back to us over a certain amount of time, and we just won't lend that out again. We have to wait for him to pay us back gradually. It was that sort of situation. So I've heard that the people who allegedly lost their money in all the bank panics, it wasn't so much that they just completely got wiped out and their money was gone for good. It was more that they couldn't get it when the bank failed because there was a run on the bank, and then they just had to wait a long time. They probably didn't get 100 cents to the dollar because obviously a lot of loans went bad. But the point is, if you had $500 in your local bank and it failed, that didn't mean that you were out $500. It just meant you couldn't touch it for a long time, and maybe you got paid $450 by next year or something. So anyway, since that was going on, given the way the fractional reserve banking system works, the total quantity of money as measured by like M1 or M2 was shrinking. Because if you've got, if a given commercial bank has, and I'm just making these numbers up, if it's got $1 million in currency in the vaults with a 10% reserve requirement, that means the total customers can have collectively $10 million in checkbook deposits with that commercial bank. So the bank's customers can all look at their ATM, I mean, they have ATMs, but look at their checkbook balances, you add up all those numbers, and that commercial bank's customers think they've got $10 million in the bank, and they're walking around town spending it. So prices got pushed up as if there really were that $10 million in existence. Now the public gets scared, they rush to that bank, and everyone tries to take his money out. Well, what happens? Well, $1 million gets withdrawn, and people now have that $1 million in paper currency. But then $9 million in other money is just—it's gone. So, because you know that $9 million didn't really correspond to paper money, that was just ledger entries on the bank's books that wasn't backed up by anything. So now prices are going to fall, because in a very real sense, money is disappearing from the economy. So that's what was going on in the early 30s, and so prices were falling. And also the demand to hold money was going up. So even if you didn't have the money stock falling, people were more anxious to just sit on their money anyway. And so that was another reason that prices would tend to fall. So that's happening, but then, unlike the 1920 and 21 depression, when the federal government just kind of sat back and let nature take its course, here Herbert Hoover did all kinds of stuff to try to get businesses to not lower wages, and he tried to prop up farm prices and things like that. So you had the federal government, more so than at any time prior to that in U.S. history, was intervening to try to prevent prices from falling. So you've got the government working against the natural direction the market wanted to take. And I think that's why unemployment went up so much. The wages were a lot harder, were a lot stickier, if you will, because I think of unions and government actions. So now in that environment, if you're just going to stipulate and say, well, take it for granted that the government's doing this, that there's a bank panic and everyone's rushing to take their money out, so prices are falling or prices want to fall and the government's not letting that happen, you could make an argument that given that scenario, inflation is a good thing. And so that's why how I would explain the fact that you had this apparent recovery the moment FDR comes into office. Because it's true, if you look at various statistics, like the unemployment rate, industrial output, I'm trying to think of some other ones, maybe investment spending, I'm not sure about investment spending. They turn around almost on a dime when Roosevelt comes in. And I think what happened is he suspended the gold standard. He took the dollar off gold. That allowed the Fed to inflate a lot. And so that started pushing up prices. So the price level, which had been falling for 4 years, turned around on a dime and started rising. So in general, in a free market economy, if the government just is a one-shot thing, comes along and inflates, obviously I wouldn't say that that's good for the economy. But what is possible, or what's arguably true, is that given the strange combination of circumstances that was happening, that were happening in 1933, you could say that actually in that scenario, inflating wasn't so bad just because it was helping to counteract some of the ridiculous interventions that were going on at the same time. Specifically, if wage rates are stuck because of the union and the government and prices want to fall, if you inflate, that might at least ease the unemployment problem, which then gets people back to work producing stuff, so then output starts going up. That's the idea. So if Rickards had something like that in mind, then I still would, like I say, I would never describe that as saying, oh, the problem in the 1930s was we didn't inflate enough. I mean, that's not the way I would characterize it. No, the problem is all the interventions and so forth. But if somebody wanted to argue along those lines, I could at least see where they were coming from. But even there, I mean, inflation at best is a short-term palliative, right? That it's you're screwing up the allocation of resources when you do it that way, because the new money comes in a certain way and messes everything up. So I don't think if FDR had just been willing to inflate more and raise the price of gold to $40 an ounce instead of $35, it's not that I think, oh, that would have nipped the depression in the bud. I just think maybe you would have seen bigger spurts in some official statistics the first few years, but then later when it crashed, it would have been a harder crash. So that's kind of how I would answer that. Okay, Benjamin says, what will be the effect of yesterday's S&P downgrade of the U.S.? Well, there's a couple things. So one is there are some heavily regulated entities in the financial sector that by law, or maybe by regulation, that was put in place by a law, are required to hold AAA securities. And so it's kind of interesting, you know, up till now, everyone just assumed that U.S. treasuries were AAA. I mean, that almost by definition, they were supposed to be the safest thing in the world. And so it's unclear how many financial instances, like, for example, if you're running a retirement fund or something, you know, you by regulation and so forth, you might be required. You can't take your employee's retirement fund and go put it in 3 biotech stocks. Like, not only is that reckless and immoral, I'm pretty sure it's illegal. You just can't do that. And so, the various regulations, they will say for certain things that were like commercial banks in terms of what do they do with their deposits and things. I mean, there are a lot of regulations in place to make sure, or insurance companies, things like that, are regulated maybe at the state level, just to try to make sure businesses don't go do something crazy with their customers' money. And so part of the way those things are codified is to say you have to have such and such proportion of your portfolio in things that are rated AAA. And so if now U.S. Treasuries aren't AAA, there's some concern about, well, holy cow, does that mean a bunch of private institutions now have to dump their U.S. Treasuries? And what's that going to do to interest rates and blah, blah, blah? So that's an interesting issue. And I think I was reading Robert Wenzel at Economic Policy Journal on this. He was saying it's not clear right now how big of an effect that issue is going to be, because the regulations, some of them might say you need to have a top rating from at least one of the big three, like Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's. And so if just S&P downgrades the U.S., but the other two don't, then maybe you're still okay as far as the regulations go. But then the question is, well, are the other ones going to follow suit? And if that happens, that's no longer going to be the case. So anyway, that's one set of issues. As far as besides people who are just by regulation required to hold AAA, just regular investors, is this going to do anything? I don't know, because I mean, it's not like I'm a trader in the markets. I'm too young, first of all. I haven't been watching that stuff long enough, and also I don't have a lot of personal wealth that's in the stock market or in the bond markets or anything, so it's not like I really watch that stuff very carefully. So I'm not sure. I don't really have a good theory in my mind about how those things work in terms of, because one school of thought would say this is completely irrelevant. Whatever information S&P was using to come to that conclusion, investors already knew that information last week. So there's no reason. In other words, it's not like anyone's like, holy cow, you're telling me the U.S. government might not be able to pay its interest payments on time? That now has come into question. I mean, everyone knows that has come into question because of the recent debt ceiling deal and because of all these projections about how the U.S. government's fiscal load is just going to be unsustainable on the current trajectory. So everybody knows that. So the fact that S&P comes along and says, U.S. debt is no longer impregnable the way it was 10 years ago, that shouldn't be a revelation to anybody. So there's that train of argument that says this is just completely irrelevant. But on the other hand, that seems a little bit too flippant to me. I don't think the markets actually work the way they're depicted in hyper-rationalistic Chicago school type models, where what I just said would be true, that people would say, you're not gleaning any information from S&P, and so why should that affect anything? For one thing, what's the point of having ratings agencies if nobody listens to them? And of course there's government intervention and all that, but even if we had a totally free market, there would still be ratings agencies. And so it can't be the case that their pronouncements literally mean nothing, because, no, they have people that are supposedly experts that do that stuff and provide information to investors so they can make better informed decisions. And so I think there's that element. But beyond that, I think there's just a, I don't know how you want to call it. For a long time now, at least since late 2008, I have been waiting for the dollar to fall. I have been wondering what the heck is going on. How come people still trust Treasuries? How come every time there is a financial crisis, investors the world over run to the dollar and U.S. Treasuries? Can't they read the numbers that I'm reading? Can't they see what Bernanke is doing? Can't they see the long-run projections of U.S. debt? I mean, this is insane. Who in their right mind thinks that the dollar right now is a safe haven and the U.S. Treasuries are the place to go for cover. So for a while, I've been thinking that's nuts, and I thought, well, it's just people are in denial, and more people have to know that the policies they're doing in Washington and the Federal Reserve Board are bad, and it's just people just can't accept that because they don't know what to do with their world if it becomes the case that the U.S. dollar is not the place to go and that the U.S. Treasury is not the safe asset, you know, par excellence. So the I didn't make this up, but I've used the analogy of Wile E. Coyote running off the cliff in the Roadrunner cartoons. And he, even though he's off the cliff, he's fine until he looks down. And then once he realizes he ran off the cliff, he starts falling, and that's it. So I kind of think for a while now, I've thought there's an analogous situation with the dollar and treasuries that we have stepped off the cliff, that we should be in free fall, but just the weird way that economies work, if everyone still thinks it's okay, it will be okay. And the dollar won't crash until some major player says, that's it, I'm out, and then everyone else runs for the exit, and then the crash will happen very quickly. So, and it's, if you buy into that narrative and that way of looking at markets, well then, this S&P thing might be the, you know, what do you call it, the first crack in the dam. And that now we've got a little trickle of water coming through that, yeah, by itself, that doesn't mean anything, but it's a harbinger of the fact that the dam is going to collapse and that we're going to get flooded. So I the downgrade to me reassured me that I'm not crazy, I'll put it that way, that the longer we persisted with low, with inflation expectations being low and apparently the bond market's saying that they think, you know, 2.5% 10-year yield is fine. I mean, that struck me as insane. How could anyone possibly think over the next 10 years that price inflation was going to be real low and that, you know, the dollar wasn't going to fall against other currencies? That struck me as crazy. And so now at least to say, all right, maybe treasuries are not the safest asset in the planet. Okay, thanks, guys. I'm glad, you know, you're starting to come around to my way of thinking. That's the way I'm looking at it. And like I say, to the extent that there is sort of herd mentality or that, well, let me put it this way. The way I've been explaining this, you know, it's either Paul Krugman is totally right and the Austrians are idiots, or there's a bubble right now in treasuries and the dollar. I mean, to me, those seem like the only real explanations for what we've seen over the last 2 years. So I don't think that Paul Krugman is right. I don't think the Austrians are idiots. So my fallback explanation is to say, yeah, I think the yields on treasuries are way too low, meaning their price is way too high. And my only explanation for that is the market is just wrong. Just like home prices in late 2005 were way too high. And somebody could have looked at that and said, oh, you guys think that there's a bubble in housing, ha-ha. Why do you think you're smarter than the markets? And you could say, well, the markets sometimes are wrong and they have bubbles. And that's what I would say right now, that largely perhaps because of the Federal Reserve waiting in the wings, always being ready to come in and buy up treasuries, you know, maybe that's what got the ball rolling and that's what sustains this precarious equilibrium. But it didn't surprise me that the stock market fell 4% a day. I mean, I have been waiting for the market to crash. I've been waiting for treasuries to crash. So, anyway, this S&P thing, like I said, is just a little bit of a confirmation for me that, okay, yeah, the situation really is awful. I'm not nuts. That these other people are nuts who think we're just hitting a rocky patch here and we just need to put our heads down and maybe print some more money and run some more deficits, and then we'll get out of this. I mean, that's insane. Okay. By the way, I hope this isn't a really depressing office hours session. Benjamin says, here's my plan to expand the Ron Paul base. He announces to all that he will have an important free webcast for all to see. When they tune in, they see you clearly explain the origin of money and how gold originally was used. Then you explain the true value of what is in their wallet, and poof, a lot more Ron Paul votes. And with the press coverage of this, Krugman demands a debate. Everybody wins, and it will show that Keynes was right about people's lack of understanding of real and nominal wages. Well, if I had my magic 8-ball, Benjamin, and shook it and said, is this going to come true, I would say my sources say no. So it's a good idea, but I don't think that's going to happen. It is funny, people, this happens a lot. I'll be at a conference. I was at Freedom Fest, for example, and some guy came up and gave me, he said, hey, I've been writing this letter to Ron Paul, and his staff isn't answering it, so here, let me give it to you, and you'll read it and see that I'm on to something here that you passed along, because they're not listening to me. And I get emails like all the time. I can just imagine how much, how many requests Lou Rockwell has to, endure, since he's obviously closer to Ron Paul than I am. So, or Tom Woods or somebody. And so what's funny is, and I understand why that happened, because I used to do that stuff too when I was younger, and I, and just getting into the movement. You see it, and you're sure that oh, these guys are on the right track. And we get this at the Mises Institute too. We'll get enthusiastic supporters that will send me email or send it to Doug French or whatever, saying, you guys are doing a great job, but if you just did this one thing, then boom, we would have freedom next Tuesday. And by the way, Benjamin, I think you're probably largely making a joke. I'm not criticizing you. I'm just taking your question as a springboard here to make a general observation that, it's funny how that happens. Or like with LouRockwell.com, when I was younger, I would look at the articles he would run, and I would think, oh man, if I were running that site, I would pick different types of articles. I would feature this person more and this person less, and I would, have this kind of tone. But the point is, by definition, you're looking at people who already are huge and popular, and so their chances are that they know what they're doing more than you do. Just like, my blog is nowhere near as well trafficked as Lou Rockwell's. So even though I would run his blog differently, if I were in charge of his blog, it wouldn't have as much traffic as his does. So he's clearly better at getting readers than I am. And Ron Paul is clearly better at getting out the message than I am, or that I would be if I were running his campaign, just to give you an example, in the 08 campaign, I could not understand why he kept talking about the Federal Reserve. Because I had been a college professor, and those lectures were incredibly boring, talking about open market operations, blah, blah, and people, jumping out the window. So I thought Ron Paul should be going around to college campuses talking about legalizing drugs and ending the war, or wars, whatever. And I thought that's the way that young kids would think he was cool, was because he was going to, he was like, hey, let's legalize drugs and let's bring troops home. But that's, of course, not what he did. He talked about monetary policy to a bunch of college kids, and they were getting all fired up, saying, end the Fed, end the Fed. I mean, I was just stunned. So my point is, at least in that thing, I just, once that happened, I stopped thinking of trying to give his campaign advice, in other words. Not that I had been doing it anyway, but I'm just saying, for a while, I thought, oh, yeah, Ron Paul's great, but he's just got, he's got people who don't know how to run his campaign. If they just tweak one thing, it would. And I think we're just taking for granted the tremendous success that he already has had. And, there might be reasons that they're not doing certain things that we're just not aware of. So, anyway, not to say that your idea wouldn't work, but I'm just saying it's I think Ron Paul is doing whatever he's doing, and he has reasons for it, and he's certainly been much more successful in getting Austrian economy. He was on Jay Leno. I couldn't believe that. I had always thought that it would take somebody that was like younger and hip or whatever word you want to use to get on some talk show and talk about that kind of thing. and here's an old guy up there, you know, talking about Austrian economics on Jay Leno. I mean, that was amazing. Incidentally, what I do think, and Tom Woods has really been just beating a warpath on this. Yeah, let me just check the time. Okay. Is that with the internet and everything, a real easy thing to do is for everyone to just individually start blasting stuff out. Because I think you guys probably underestimate the influence that has. So instead of thinking in terms of big picture, like, oh, if only Ron Paul would do this, or, oh, man, if the Institute would just, you know, go around, get $500,000 from their donors, and then pay Paul Krugman $300,000 to debate Bob Murphy in Auburn under the lights and, you know, put DVDs out, you know, if they would just do that, I mean, it's possible those things are all true, don't get me wrong, but what I'm saying is there's stuff you can do yourself, and maybe you bring in 5 people a week, and you might think, well, that's not worth the effort, but if there's 1,000 people like you, of course, you know, wondering, man, what needs to happen in order to tip the scales in our favor, well, if 1,000 people are doing that, that's 5,000 people a week, all right, so you see what I'm saying, and you know, thinking back to how did you get into it? Now, I know with the Ron Paul thing, a lot of people I talk to say the reason they got into Austrian economics was because of the Ron Paul campaign. So, I mean, there it doesn't work so much. But for me, at least, I got into it because of my dad listening to Rush Limbaugh, and then I started reading conservative op-ed columnists like Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell, and then I just kept, you know, going to harder and harder stuff, like, you know, then I got into Henry Hazlitt, and then that led me to Mises and Rothbard and so forth. So, I mean, that's the thing, too. So, like just for me personally, I just keep telling myself that, no, every time I write an op-ed for a newspaper, it's possible when I'm talking about free trade or something that somebody out there, some 15-year-old kid, is going to read that and has never heard that before. And say, oh, my gosh. I never thought of it that way, and then it's going to get hooked. And that's it's a long-term thing, and it seems like it's not giving you results right away, but over the long term, you know, I think that's how the movement grows. And so, I would just encourage you guys, and especially like Tom Woods keeps stressing with the internet now, I mean, you can, if you just start like a, what do you call those things, a vlog, where you just do short little video clips, because now people's attention span is so low, they don't even want to read articles. And so if you just do like a weekly thing or something, you get a nice camera and so forth. I mean, and I'm derelict in that respect as well, that Tom has been telling me, you know, Bob, you need to be doing that, and I should be doing that. It's just I've been too lazy to get around to getting the lighting in my office right and everything. So anyway, and that's the sort of thing, too, where people, when they start a blog and I tell them, you're not going to see a lot of traffic for 2 years. But you just got to keep doing your thing, figure out what kind of blog you want to have, and just keep doing that, and eventually you'll start picking up readers. But in the beginning, it's going to seem like it's a complete waste of your time. So that's the kind of stuff. And the other thing, too, to guard against is don't be worried that, oh, well, you know, why would I be blogging about Austrian economics when we've got the Mises Institute faculty doing stuff. But that's because we can't deal with everything. Or maybe you'll put it in a certain way, or you'll use a metaphor that will make it click for some people that we can't do. So that's and the other thing, too, is a lot of people make their decisions based on what they think is popular or what they think everybody else believes. In other words, they're not independent thinkers, and so part of how we get more people to support the gold standard, for example, or better yet, just flat out free market money that would probably happen to be gold, is they just need more and more people to think like that. So if it's just you think, oh, it's Ron Paul and four guys with PhDs who hang out in Auburn, Alabama, and everybody else thinks that the gold standard caused the Great Depression, you're going to have a hard time winning that battle. The only people that are going to agree with you are people that are cocky enough and independent-minded enough to not care that they hold a very minority viewpoint. And unfortunately, most people don't think like that. Most people think that, no, if a lot of all these smart people are saying something's wrong, it must be wrong. And so just by you talking about gold in the right way or talking about free markets, opposing the bailout, saying Bernanke's crazy, whatever, that helps turn public opinion against that stuff just because there's one more voice beating that drum, even if you personally aren't saying something particularly novel. Okay. Yang Tana says, all right, well, and Benjamin doesn't like my answer, and he keeps telling me, no, his plan would work. You might be right, Benjamin. It might work. And I'm telling you it's not going to happen, that there's no way Paul Krugman would ever debate me unless he gets a huge check. And so I'm saying, in the meantime, think of what you can do to help. Because that particular plan, unfortunately, even though you might be perfectly correct that if it happened, it would be awesome, I don't think it's going to happen. So think of what can you do to incrementally get more people interested in Ron Paul or whatever. Okay, Hang Tana says, and this is going to be the last question for this office hour session, what could be the long-term effect of current American crisis on China and developing countries? You know, I don't know. I mean, I'll give you some generic thoughts, but this, I'm very U.S. centric in my analysis, just because my time is limited, and I only actually read about 6 blogs, which some people are shocked when they learn that, because I know some people literally have hundreds of blogs on their blog reader and that kind of thing, and I just that would take too much of my time. So, as far as China, I mean, they're in a tough spot, at least their government is, because they're sitting on so much dollar-denominated debt. So they don't want the dollar to crash. But at the same time, I think they would benefit in the long term if the U.S. is weakened as a world power for various reasons. And so, even if it's just purely an economic thing, if the U.S. government is running huge budget deficits and interest rates go up and pricing from the dollar keeps losing value and people are, you know, there's riots and stuff, I mean, the U.S. government can't police the world nearly as effectively in that situation. You know, they would have to cut back on military spending. They would have to scale back their ambitions of taking over the Middle East, basically, and so forth, affecting the way geopolitical events unfold. And I'm assuming the people in the Chinese government are very happy to see that come true. So I think in the long term, from the point of view of the ruling elites in Asian countries, they're probably just saying, yep, we could see this was coming. The U.S. was a world empire, and just like all previous world empires, they overreached, and now they're collapsing. And we just have to be patient and just sit here and wait 20 years, and then it'll be our time. So I imagine that's partly how they're thinking, and so they think this stuff is great. But as far as the average family in China, what is this going to do? I'm not sure. I guess I would frame it as, what is the Chinese government going to do in terms of its domestic policies as the U.S. implodes? That are they going to, because in various respects, the Chinese government has, and you can correct me if you disagree, has been liberalizing things. I mean, they've been signing free trade agreements. They've been doing stuff about letting people, at least is my understanding, you know, have limited private property rights in their own communities in terms of farming and so forth, and they can now sell or at least rent out the various adjacent plots of land to like some international company coming in and then engaging in large-scale industrial agriculture, whereas before you couldn't do that. Like the people couldn't, you know, you had to individually farm the adjacent pieces of land because it just the way it worked. So I think that there's a huge potential for massive economic growth in some of the underdeveloped areas of the world just because they've been held back so long by their tyrannical governments. So how is that going to play out? Are they going to – and I think part of what's been happening is they were going that direction, seeing the tangible benefits of it, while the U.S. and other Western countries were going the opposite way and crippling their own economies. So I don't know how that plays out. Now, if the U.S. starts collapsing, does that take the pressure off of these more authoritarian regimes? And then they say, oh, okay, well, now we don't have to give so much freedom to our people because, you know, the modest economic growth we're getting from the limited freedom we've given them is all we need right now to outcompete the U.S. in terms of its military machine. You know, I don't know how that trade-off works. Because in other words, here's what I'm trying to say. Other things equal, people in various governments like having more power. But they're not stupid. They can understand, especially if they're in an authoritarian regime where they're going to be in power or the regime is going to be in power for decades, and so they can think long term. They can realize, well, if we give some limited property rights to our people, we'll have faster economic growth, even though we'll have to tie our hands and not have as much arbitrary power. We can see the relationship between economic freedom and growth. And so if they're thinking we really need to start cranking out our economy and our growth rates, they might be willing to cede some of the power back to their people. And I think that's partly what's been going on the last decade. So my point is, if now the U.S. collapses as a world empire and China is basically the strongest regime standing, are they then going to crack down more on their people and realize, okay, now we have no competitors, we can focus on the threats, the internal threats to our regime, whereas before we were worried about making sure the U.S. government didn't come up with some pretext to try to encroach on our ambitions. You know, now the only real threat is, you know, people surfing the internet and getting all kinds of wacky ideas, and so we got to crack down on that. You know, I don't know how that plays out. But so I'm not answering your question. I'm just kind of giving you the way I would frame it, in other words. Like, I think those are the trade-offs. It's also true, I believe, that the Chinese central bank has been inflating, and they're now seeing the problems of that, and so there might be a crash in China, an economic crash in China in the short term. And so that's, I think, going to be bad, and that might be a reason that might provide the pretext for which the Chinese officials then would roll back some of these liberties they've granted in recent years if they thought that the U.S. is in the toilet. It might play out that way. So, you know, you've got people like Jim Rogers moving to Asia, and I think he's right in his big picture vision. I think the 21st century will not be the American century by any stretch. I think it would be, if you had to pick, the Chinese century. And I just hope they continue on their trajectory of granting more and more liberty to their people, because they realize that there's pragmatic benefits from that as well. But I don't know if that's how it's going to play out. All right, well, we'll stop there, guys, and Remember, tonight is the lecture with Peter Klein, if you're able to tune into that. And I think it's a, let me just double check. Yeah, it's at 5 p.m. Eastern time. Tonight is the lecture with Peter Klein, if you can watch that. Okay, guys, see you later.